Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Vertical Space, a podcast at the intersection of technology and flight. We are your hosts, Jim Barry and Luka Tomjanovic, and here we look at the most important forces shaping the market of advanced air mobility, with a particular focus on why and how they matter to those building a business in this very exciting and growing industry.
The development of the system was probably only about 10% of the effort. The other 90% was the validation. And I think that has really influenced how I've been thinking about autonomy and other areas of aerospace, where the big effort is in validation. To do validation well, you need really good models of the environment, and you also need quite a bit of compute power to really probe all the different edge cases. And you also need really good tools to figure out what are the edge cases that we care about and how to categorize them.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to The Vertical Space. Happy New Year. Today's discussion is with Dr. Michael Korkendorfer, Associate Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at Stanford. He's the director of the Stanford Intelligent Systems Laboratory, conducting research on advanced algorithms and analytical methods for the design of robust decision-making systems. Among his many accomplishments, and a lot of you will know Michael because he led the ACAS-X effort, which was a really successful recent airborne collision avoidance system. He also has a really good view on the practical implementation and validation of autonomy. Michael talks about building highly robust systems that interact with humans in the real world. He discusses the team behind the Airborne Collision Avoidance System X, or ACAS-X, what drove the need for ACAS-X, how it was accomplished, and its terrific results. As I mentioned, you're going to hear about the practical implementation and validation of autonomy in aviation and advanced air mobility. His discussion around autonomy is important for everyone to hear, and that although elements of autonomy are a long way off in aviation and advanced air mobility, he has confidence that AI and autonomy can be applied to many areas of aviation and advanced air mobility. Also, we have a great discussion around simulation, its importance, and the different types of simulation. Michael, thanks for joining us, and to our guests, enjoy Michael's important talk as you innovate in the vertical space.
This episode of the Vertical Space podcast is brought to you by UAvionics. UAvionics is the leader in low size, weight, and power certified avionics for manned, unmanned, and advanced air mobility aircraft. Let UAvionics help you achieve your goals, whether that be type certification, airspace access, or beyond visual line of sight operations. UAvionics has certified and certifiable communications, navigation, and surveillance avionics for your aircraft. So head over to uavionics.com or Google it to see how you can start flying safer and move your platform forward into shared airspace.
Dr. Michael Korkendorfer is Associate Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at Stanford. He's the Director of the Stanford Intelligent Systems Laboratory, conducting research on advanced algorithms and analytical methods for the design of robust decision-making systems. Of particular interest are systems for air traffic control, unmanned aircraft, and automated driving, where decisions must be made in uncertain dynamic environments while maintaining safety and efficiency. Research at SISL focuses on efficient computational methods for driving optimal decision strategies from high-dimensional probabilistic problem representations. Prior to joining the Stanford faculty in 2013, he was at MIT Lincoln Laboratory, where he worked on airborne collision avoidance, leading to the creation of ACAS-X, International Standard for Manned and Unmanned Aircraft. He received his PhD from the University of Edinburgh in 2006. He received his BS and MS degrees in computer science from Stanford University in 2003. Professor Korkendorfer is the co-director of the Center for AI Safety. He is an associate editor for the Journal of Artificial Intelligence Research and the Journal of Aerospace Information Systems. He is an author of the textbooks Decision-Making Under Uncertainty, Theory and Application, Algorithms for Optimization, and Algorithms for Decision-Making, all from MIT Press. Michael, welcome to the Vertical Space. Great having you on. And please say hello to Luka Tomjanovic.
Hello.
Hi, Michael. Welcome.
Is there anything that very few in the industry agree with you on?
I think one area would be really the difficulty of building highly robust systems that interact with humans and the real world. And this is actually something that I haven't had a full appreciation of, but over the past 15 years, I've been reminded over and over how hard it is to build highly robust systems.
Michael, what exactly do you mean by highly robust? And why do people underestimate this difficulty?
So I've seen this in systems ranging from aircraft to cars, automated driving, and so forth. What I mean by highly robust, I mean systems that are robust to sensor errors, so failures in the system or occlusions. Like if we're building an autonomous car, maybe a truck in front of us might be blocking the visibility of our sensors. Also, robustness to uncertainty in what might happen in the future. Maybe another aircraft, you know, passes in front of us or they begin a turn. We need to build systems that are robust to the full spectrum of what we might expect. And it turns out that there are just a lot of edge cases in the real world.
And Michael, people don't agree with you in this area? Well, how do they not agree with you?
Well, I think sometimes they understand that it's difficult, but maybe there's a bit of an underestimate of how much it takes to build both a robust system and then take it through the validation process to establish confidence that the system will behave as expected when deployed in the real world.
What domain do you think that these kinds of robust systems will develop first?
Well, we've been working in the area of aircraft collision avoidance systems. We have been working on a system called ACAS-X, the Airborne Collision Avoidance System X. This goes back, you know, 15 years back when I was at MIT Lincoln Laboratory. And we really just approached those challenges head on, you know, uncertainty in the sensor system, uncertainty in the future behavior of other pilots. And I think those were some, you know, fairly early work. And we're hoping that many of those ideas will spur the development in drones and urban air mobility systems and so forth.
Before we get into the collision avoidance, which we're really mm-hmm. looking forward to, it's groundbreaking work. If somebody heard the name Michael Korkendorfer, what first comes to their mind in the work that you've done? What are the three bullet points that should jump to their minds when they hear your name?
Oh, okay. okay, so one would be the idea of a POMDP or a partially observable Markov decision process. I didn't invent this concept. The ideas go back to the 50s and 60s, but I've been working really hard to popularize it and make tools accessible to the general engineering audience. So the idea of a POMDP is it's just a mathematical model of a sequential decision process. So that captures uncertainty in state of the system. Due to, you know, imperfect sensor measurements. It captures uncertainty in the future evolution of the system. It's a very general mathematical model, can be applied to automated driving, financial domains, aviation, and so forth. Anyway, that's one area.
How does that compare with Markov decision process? Similar?
Similar. So the Markov decision process was popularized by Richard Bellman in the 1950s. It's a special case of a POMDP, but in an MDP, you assume that you know the state of the world exactly. So there's no sensor uncertainty or anything like that. And it's really the partial observability that makes this model much more powerful and applicable, especially to aerospace systems where you need to be robust to that kind of uncertainty. So I think people might think of POMDPs. Actually, the motto of our lab is life is a POMDP. My students start thinking about how they approach, I don't know, everything in life, whether it's relationships or, you know, finding a job as a partially observable Markov decision process. Maybe another point would be, well, I'm hoping that people will know me for the books that I've written. Mm-hmm. The most recent one being titled Algorithms for Decision Making. And I've tried to make it as accessible as possible to a general engineering and scientific audience. Those books are available from MIT Press, but they're also available online for free as a PDF. So it's a free download. And then maybe the third thing would be, if we're just looking at an application, perhaps ACAS-X, the Airborne Collision Avoidance System X. But I should emphasize there that the creation of ACAS-X was a major team effort. a team effort that spanned, Lincoln Laboratory, Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, the MITRE Corporation, and of course it was led by the FAA, and it involved the cooperation and collaboration with people all around the world, and that has been hugely satisfying for me.
Many of the listeners will know about TCAS, mm-hmm. and they'll know about the advancements from TCAS. What drove the need for ACAS, and how was it done?
Actually, it goes back to 2006 when I joined the group at Lincoln Laboratory that originally developed TCAS, and we wanted to explore a general approach for building and optimizing collision avoidance systems for different types of drones. So the focus was originally on drones. And the reason for that is, around that time, the DoD, DHS, commercial entities wanted to fly drones in a more flexible manner in civil airspace, but they needed a detect and avoid capability. But we couldn't go through the same kind of lengthy process that was required for building TCAS. So we wanted to come up with a more flexible system that could be optimized for, different kinds of sensor modalities and different kinds of aircraft platforms. And we did a small initial study, and it turned out to work really well. In fact, I thought it would just be, a side project for, 9 months or so. But it turned out to work really well. And when the FAA saw the technology, we started thinking, maybe this could be a future drop-in replacement to TCAS. That line of thinking was driven by the need to make adaptations for next-gen operations that were on the horizon then, especially with the later mandate with ADS-B. And also at the same time, just further enhancing safety. And then ultimately, it turned into an international standard in 2018 for manned aircraft, and then 2020 for large unmanned aircraft.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference between TCAS and ACAS? As I recall, TCAS is really based on estimating and calculating aircraft trajectories based on the geometry itself, whereas ACAS-X takes a probabilistic approach about where the aircraft could be maneuvering in the future. Did I miss something, or can you elaborate
on
this?
No, that's about right. So TCAS, we have to emphasize, was designed specifically for large commercial aircraft. And I should also emphasize that it has been a major success story, especially in the United States. So since TCAS has been deployed, TCAS-2, there have been zero mid-air collisions involving a TCAS-equipped aircraft. And so you're right. So TCAS requires some kind of prediction where the other aircraft will be in the future. And actually what it does is it uses straight line projection, right? And then, of course, aircraft don't always fly in straight lines. And so the decision rules or decision logic that underlie TCAS, they have to throw in additional thresholds and heuristics and so forth to provide robustness. So it turns out that in order to build or achieve the level of robustness that's required of commercial aircraft, that requires a whole bunch of rules. And it quickly becomes very complicated, much more complicated than I anticipated when I first joined that group in 2006. Even as a third generation pilot, I thought, how hard is this? If the aircraft is above us, then we just descend. If they're below us, then just climb. How hard can this be? ACAS-X takes a different kind of approach. It also has to make predictions about what might be happening in the future, but it uses a probabilistic model for predicting where other aircraft will be. And, probabilities are assigned to the full spectrum of different maneuvers that might happen. And it relies upon an approach called dynamic programming to figure out the best possible maneuver that, minimizes the probability of a mid-air collision while also at the same time minimizing the number of unnecessary alerts and so forth. Relieves the human designer to some extent of having to anticipate, you know, the full spectrum of what might happen. And we rely upon largely dynamic programming to reason about all the different things that might happen.
What are the probabilities based on? How does the system assign probabilities to understand where the aircraft might go next? Do they need to understand behaviors of individual human pilots in order to assign those probabilities?
Yeah, everything that we're uncertain about, we use a probabilistic model. So we're uncertain about, you know, how long the pilot might take to respond to their resolution advisory, is uncertain about exactly how the right. aircraft will maneuver. So the question is, you know, where do those probabilities come from?
And I mean, moving from a fairly deterministic TCAS system to a non-deterministic ACAS X system, that must have raised a lot of eyebrows at the FAA.
Ah, okay. Yes.
So how does one formally and effectively validate such a non-deterministic system and in a way that makes regulators comfortable?
Great question. And there's one very important thing that I should clarify here. And this is something that, you know, early in the discussions with the FAA and the international community, ACAS-X is a deterministic system in the sense that given the same sequence of inputs, it will generate the same set of outputs. But what's different is that the mechanism within ACAS-X is optimized with respect to a probabilistic model. So it reasons about the probability of different things happening, but that reasoning is perfectly deterministic. And it needs to be deterministic. That determinism is absolutely critical in making this system a standard, and it greatly simplifies the validation process as well.
If drones and unmanned aircraft were not introduced to the airspace, would there be an ACAS-X?
Yes. So I should also emphasize that there are different flavors for ACAS-X. There's XA, which is a drop-in replacement for TCAS, so targeting the larger manned aircraft. There's XU for large unmanned aircraft. There's SXU for small unmanned aircraft. And under development now is XR for rotorcraft and advanced air mobility systems. So there are different flavors here, but I think we would still have a need for XA for manned aircraft, even if there weren't any drones. And the reason for that is we want to be able to support next-gen operations. So closely spaced, you know, parallel runway operations. So XA and XO, XO are for operations-specific context. But we need something like that for next-gen.
Some of our audience might be familiar with other collision avoidance algorithms, perhaps like Daedalus. Mm-hmm. Can you comment, what's the landscape of all the collision avoidance systems out there, and how does Daedalus compare to ACAS-X?
Great question. So ACAS-X is last layer of defense. It's not aiming to provide separation assurance. It's purely collision avoidance. And the methodologies that we use in ACAS-X are a bit different from other systems.
So with, you know, the drone operators, advanced air mobility companies that are listening right now, how does this impact them?
So some might be interested in using XU or SXU. They may need to think about how to interoperate with XA and TCAS, because they'll potentially be interacting with other aircraft that have these systems on board, including TCAS. TCAS will be around for a while still.
How does your work on the ACAS-X inform your views about successful implementation of autonomy in aviation?
It has. I should also emphasize that the development of the system was probably only about 10% of the effort. The other 90% was the validation. And I think that has really influence how I've been thinking about autonomy and other areas of aerospace, where, you know, the big effort is in validation. To do validation well, you need really good models of the environment, and you also need quite a bit of compute power to really probe all the different edge cases. And you also need really good tools to figure out what are the edge cases that we care about and how to categorize them and so forth.
I'd really like to spend a bit more time on this topic of validation of complex and robust systems. What does validation look like today? And how is this not adequate or efficient enough?
I think today, with a lot of these startups, the focus is really on building a proof of concept and getting it to a flight test. But before there is widespread adoption, there needs to be a significant amount of modeling and simulation. It's just not feasible to flight test anything in all the various configurations that you'll expect. So I can tell you how we approached it for ACAS-X. We collected a huge amount of data. I think it was something like 15 gigabytes per day worth of radar data from every FAA and Department of Defense radar. And that streamed into Lincoln Laboratory, and we built these probabilistic models of the environment. We used a representation known as a dynamic Bayesian network. We learned the statistical relationships between all the various variables, and we then were able to use that model to create synthetic encounter situations. In fact, I think during the process of developing ACAS-X, we ran something like tens of billions of simulations, probing, you know, all the different ways that they can be approaching each other and the maneuvers that they might take over time. And that was absolutely critical. So you use those models to validate the avionics. You also need to validate the models you're using for validation as well, right? So how do you go about ensuring that, you know, in this case, a dynamic Bayesian network adequately represents the airspace? So there are a few different ways to go about doing that. Many of them are kind of technical and have at their roots, you know, statistics and machine learning, and there are some quantitative metrics. But another metric that's a little bit more qualitative is, and sometimes we just call this a Turing test after Alan Turing, where we generate a whole bunch of synthetic tracks, and we collect a whole bunch of real aircraft tracks. We try to have a human expert, a pilot or someone who has worked with radar, try to determine which is which. And if we're able to fool them half the time, then we know we're doing a good job.
So to follow up on Lucas' question on autonomy, I mean, it appears, Michael, that with advanced air mobility, mm-hmm. autonomy is almost critical to the profitable operations of a lot of these vehicles. Based on the work that you've done and the validation work that you've done, how do you view a full autonomous aircraft, a pilotless aircraft, you know, moving passengers? How do you see the future, and how should we be approaching autonomy?
Great question. So it goes back to what is autonomy? Autonomy is really just automating a system in an incredibly vast set of situations. So you can't hard code exactly what the vehicle should do in every possible situation. And so you have to rely upon, you know, autonomy algorithms to do that for you. So this requires, of course, a lot of validation, modeling, and simulation. But I think that the way forward here is to take baby steps, right? There's a lot of uncertainty as we build these systems. And the right approach is to take baby steps and establish confidence as we go along.
How does one know that they have collected an adequate amount of data or adequate number of simulation runs? How do you draw this threshold?
That's a really tough question, right? because you can always do more. The more data you have, the better the models will be. I think sometimes people are tempted to think in terms of, you know, maybe thousands of situations, but we're going to need millions or billions of situations to really stress the system. And the reason for that is because of the dimensionality of the environment. You have so many different things that can vary. You can change the vertical rate of the aircraft, you know, 15 seconds into the future. You can have different kinds of sensor errors at different points in the flight. There are just so many different free variables here that you can't explore all the different kinds of combinations. And so you need both good techniques, good methodologies for exploring that vast space, but you also need quite a bit of computation as well.
And given this infinite space of potential outcomes and states, how do we satisfy our expectation of safety? There will always be new edge cases that come up that we haven't thought about. So is it about doing more with existing data? Is it, you know, obtaining more data, more simulation? Are we in a constant race here with ourselves?
So in some cases, it's just not possible to get more data. So for an example, we were working on a project with Airbus, and we wanted to create a model like what we did for ACAS-X, but that would have these urban air mobility systems in it. But the problem is there's no data to collect. And so we had to come up with different methodologies to create synthetic data. Now, if your models are wrong, all the conclusions that you draw from them will be wrong.
Right.
So sometimes what you have to do is sometimes you just have to make something up, maybe make up a range of, I don't know, accelerations that you might see. And then you look at sensitivity studies. So maybe you do a sweep over different distributions over encounter characteristics, and you see how that impacts your end metrics, where your metrics might include, you know, frequency of near mid-air collisions or, you know, uncomfortable accelerations and so forth. At the end of the day, you can only do the best you can. There are methods that allow you to estimate your epistemic uncertainty, so your uncertainty in what you can draw from these models. And if there's too much uncertainty there, then maybe you just have to hold off until you get more information about what to expect.
Let's say we had somebody with almost unlimited funds, and they said, I need to have a fully autonomous aircraft in 5 years. Mm-hmm. What would be your 3-point plan to make that happen? And what would have to occur to make it happen?
Okay, 3-point plan to actually build the robust, build the system and validate it?
Yep.
Well, the first part would be to obtain or build good models of the sensor error characteristics. That might come from, I don't know, the manufacturers, or it could come from bench tests or whatever. The second part is come up with good models of the environment. So, you know, what do we expect at the particular flight levels where we're expecting the vehicle to fly at? You know, some kind of characterization of the environment. And then we'll need to optimize the decision-making and control of that system. I think I already blasted through 3 parts of this, but...
Michael, what about...
I would assume some of the data that you accessed at Lincoln Lab, the, you know, from the air traffic data and the like, could be very viable to the people trying to build and validate a autonomous system, or it'd almost be needed, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so the data... We were getting raw data, and that is just not publicly available, but there are now other kinds of data sources from ADS-B and so forth that are available to commercial entities. I should also mention that the models that we developed back then, they're all publicly available now. That you can get them off of the Lincoln Laboratory GitHub. So although we couldn't release the raw data, we did obtain permission to release the models that were derived from that data.
Michael, what about models of human behavior? I mean, that seems like a really integral part, especially for autonomous systems that need to make predictions mm-hmm. about how humans will behave in complex situations. And I guess this is a lot greater of a problem in ground mobility, where you're really interacting with humans a lot more and you're not really in a structured, well-understood environment as it exists in aviation. But to what extent do we really need to understand how the human mind works in order to crack the autonomy problem?
So you don't necessarily need to understand how the human mind works at a microscopic level, like, you know, what's going on in, you know, the cerebellum or whatever. You just care to the extent it influences the trajectories of the aircraft. You also need to kind of infer the intent of the humans as well. But we've written a number of papers related to this for automated vehicles on the ground. So for an example, if you see that someone's swerving a lot, then you may infer that the latent or hidden state of that human is that, I don't know, they're distracted or drunk. And so knowing that is important because that allows you to come up with better predictions of what they might be doing in the future. So maybe as they're passing to from behind us, maybe we're just a little bit more cautious. But it's really important to have these models, at least at the macroscopic level. So you can collect statistics about what you see in the real world. You can come up with simulator studies and try to derive human behavior models from that. In some situations, that's not really feasible. And so in some cases, you just make it up and then play with the sensitivity of that model. So for an example, if you're trying to model how long it will take for a human to respond to, I don't know, some kind of advisory, you can make up some kind of, like, I don't know, exponential distribution or Gaussian, truncated Gaussian distribution. And then you can optimize your system with respect to that and see how much difference that makes on the end system. It could be that it's not very sensitive to the form and parameters of that distribution. And if not, then you can commit to one and use it. But you do have to be a bit careful to make sure that you're assigning probabilities that are roughly in the right ballpark.
Going back to our investor who said, I want fully autonomous vehicles in 5 years and I'm willing to spend anything. Is he or she wasting their money thinking it could be done in 5 years?
Well, it really depends upon what they're wanting. If they're wanting to do something like autonomous cargo aircraft in unpopulated areas, versus, you know, fully automating commercial air transport, that the latter is just not going to happen, right? Not just for technical reasons, but policy
certification
and regulatory. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
In unpopulated areas with cargo aircraft, that could conceivably happen if they got certified in time.
Possibly. I know that there has been, you know, pretty amazing progress over the past few years in that domain. From places like Reliable Robotics.
I mean, you can still argue, Michael, right, that even those kinds of aircraft will need to land at busy airports and share runways mm-hmm. and other mm-hmm. you know, airport surfaces with other passenger-carrying crewed aircraft. Same with flying inevitably over some kind of population density. So at some point, you still need to prove that these systems are reliable and...
Exactly.
Safe enough, right?
Exactly. But safe enough is dependent upon the likelihood and severity of different outcomes.
Sure.
So it depends quite a bit on the scoping. But you're right. Even for cargo aircraft, of course, there's going to be risk over even unpopulated areas and around terminal areas.
So without naming companies, mm-hmm. the technologies that are being developed in autonomy, in aviation autonomy today, how scalable do you think that those concepts are?
So some of the concepts I think are scalable. I guess it depends on what you mean by scalable, but like replicated or what do you mean?
Yeah, so what I'm alluding to is developing subsystems with the assumption that they will be able to be taken from one platform, one mission, easily onto the next one without a lot of modification.
I think a lot of it is scalable. The sensor systems are fairly modular. The actuators are fairly modular. There still is a lot of complexity in the integration of all of these different components and optimizing the decision making and control for the particular application. Just building any kind of aerospace system, it involves integrating a lot of different components that affect each other in very complicated ways.
Right, because it is about a much broader system safety picture, right? It's not about, you know, I want to deliver cargo between point A and point B. Mm-hmm. And so here's my solution, here's my sensor suite, and I should be good. But rather it's about, you know, what do we know about the aerodynamics of this aircraft? What do we know about the environment, the routes, the population density,
exactly.
all the sort of definitions of air and ground risk. And then that really sort of means that a rigorous subsystem might not be good enough.
That's right. Yeah. Aerospace design is fundamentally an interdisciplinary process. And that's something that we drill into the minds of the graduate students and actually undergraduates in our department here at Stanford.
Right. Well, allow me to just go a layer deeper, Jim, and then you can take it. But what's the existing best practice in terms of wrapping autonomy into safety critical operations in aviation? One common approach is to take whatever untrusted components might exist on an aircraft and put some kind of a deterministic wrapper around it and understand within this constraint the inputs and outputs of the system well enough to have adequate comfort in its operation. But once the system goes outside of those comfort boundaries, you know, what happens then? Do we always need to have a person somewhere in the control room ready to intervene? And if so, mm-hmm. you know, is this really the path forward to scalable operations?
Right. So you're alluding to like safety controllers. So if certain aspects are outside of the bounds of tolerance, whether it be something related to the actuator or sensor inputs or whatever, then there's some kind of backup system. So
exactly. And alternatively, you know, what is the approach to get comfortable with increasing levels of autonomy?
Oh, yeah. So I think maybe about 80% of it boils down to just modeling and simulation, where you just see what happens when different aspects occur in a way that's unexpected, and seeing how a model of the system behaves. So that's about 80% of it. The other part is you build up the sophistication of the what you're testing out in flight tests and kind of probing the envelope of what you're comfortable with. So there's a lot of complexity there when you're trying to figure out what kind of safety controller to use, what is the decision mechanism that would switch between the standard control law and the safety control law. That itself is a system that requires more modeling and simulation to really validate at design time that it's behaving the way you want.
Michael, you've talked about that in one of your talks, that computer scientists have no idea of the complexity of the airspace. And boy, I've seen that, you know, throughout the years. And is it true also for example, those building and trying to deploy and operate drones and let's say eVTOL? Mm-hmm. And also kind of the second part of the same questions. We recently had a guest on, Greg Brenneman, and Greg said that it's going to take a lot longer than people realize to deploy these capabilities. You know, one of the reasons being just the airspace and
yep.
air traffic management and air traffic control. Given the work that you've done in AI and, you know, what you've seen with some of the vehicles that are trying to be deployed, what's the best way to deploy? And what are the hurdles that they have to overcome as it relates to air traffic management and control?
In that context, there's what a lot of people refer to as the long tail, referring to the long probability tail over low probability events that could be catastrophic. And that can range from, you know, different kinds of sensor failures or sensor errors. Sometimes it's not just like a complete failure of the sensor, but it might be just, you know, small errors that accumulate over time that can just be catastrophic. And it's really easy to overlook these and underestimate the severity of what might result. We as humans, we like to think roughly deterministically, like if we do this, then they'll do that and whatnot. But often what really causes problems in aerospace and actually all forms of autonomy are these low probability tail events. So we need ways to explore that tail at design time. As much as we can understand and characterize these low probability events that are catastrophic, the better. And so naturally, a number of the PhD theses that have been coming out of our lab have been exploring pretty general methodologies that would allow us to do this for a variety of different domains. And I can elaborate on that if you're curious.
Yeah, Michael, what's the state of the art when it comes to simulation technology, and what are some of the remaining gaps there?
So there are a few challenges in simulation. You need a good way to simulate the perception of the environment. And there's like AirSim from Microsoft Research that simulates different kinds of sensors, including electro-optical, infrared kinds of sensors. There are other commercial tools out there. It's not just that. You want to be able to have good models of what the other humans in the environment are doing, what the pilots are commanding their aircraft to do. You need some way of exploring that space. So one kind of approach that we developed is called adaptive stress testing. And the idea there is you have a probabilistic model of the environment, and it will use a form of reinforcement learning to figure out what the most likely trajectory is, the most likely trajectory that will lead to failure. And there are different kinds of approaches you can use to find that. One would be a form of Monte Carlo tree search, which is what underlies AlphaGo, the mechanism from DeepMind, the algorithm from DeepMind that allowed them to beat Lee Sedol in Computer Go. And you can also use neural networks as a way to search this space. Anyway, this is still a very much an active area of research for us. We've released tools to the general public. You can find it up on our GitHub, implementations in Python and Julia. And it's being used across domains, not just aerospace, but also automated vehicles and flight management systems and so forth.
Michael, given the work that you've done in optimization algorithms and the work with, for example, Tim Wheeler with algorithms for optimization, mm-hmm. and getting back to the air traffic control and air traffic management discussion, and also given the long tail you just mentioned, is there ever a world where this is a rather automated process, air traffic management and air traffic control, or where there'll always be a human in the loop, you know, somebody who's separating an aircraft given the long tail?
Great question. So actually, I'm teaching a course here in Oxford right now as part of a Stanford study abroad program, and it's titled AI and Society. And a natural question that comes up in these discussions is, oh, well, AI will never be able to do art, or AI will never be able to, you know, fill in the blank. And when people make those statements, I become really curious about, like, why? Why is it fundamentally impossible for an AI system to do whatever? And I really do think that there's a possibility of being able to, you know, fully automate the air traffic control system. I can't think of a good reason why not on a technical level, perhaps on a societal or regulatory side, it would be very, very difficult. I mean, people have been looking at research programs for automating air traffic control for, you know, decades, many decades. And the progress there has been quite limited. But I think what we'll see is an incremental approach to increasing levels of automation.
Getting back to advanced air mobility, where do you see opportunities in advanced air mobility that perhaps innovators or companies aren't paying attention to today?
I think there are opportunities in terms of like end applications or
Correct.
I am continuously blown away by how vast the opportunities are. I was at the White House a few months ago, and the chief of the Choctaw Nation talked about how this new type of aviation would be huge. It would bring a huge benefit to the Choctaw Nation in terms of making transportation more possible, and that would open up huge economic opportunities for them. My focus has really been on coming up with general methodologies for making safer and more robust systems and validating them. But I've been continuously amazed by where all these various startup companies are going in terms of application.
And what about in terms of the build out of the foundational technologies? What remaining areas should entrepreneurs be focusing on?
I think the focus should really be on the 90% of the effort, which is the validation aspect of it. I think that needs to be taken much more seriously. And we need to be able, we need to build aircraft that not just passes the criteria for the FAA, but it needs to pass our own criteria, our own standards for safety. And we have to be held to the highest possible standards.
One of the reasons our safety system is as good as it is, you know, a couple decades ago, they talked about sharing safety data between airlines and companies.
Yeah, through the ASAIS program. Exactly.
Right. Michael, to what extent will validation be something that teams do at design time versus something that's done in real time in operation? And how are the two intertwined?
Ah, okay. So you mean validation like as the aircraft is flying?
Correct.
Oh, you want to move as much of the validation to design time as possible.
Certainly. Yeah. But I guess where I was going with the question was more around some kind of real-time feedback loop that the autonomous system behaves in a way that you would expect it to behave. And that the behavior is validated in a way.
Oh, okay. I got it. So I would call that runtime monitoring. And that's also an area of research for us. So runtime monitoring, it can perhaps detect when you're in a situation that's quite different from what's expected, from what your neural networks or whatever might be trained upon, or what you've tuned your control laws to accept. So that's very important. Most of what I've been talking about in terms of validation, it's validation at design time. And this is absolutely critical. You don't want unexpected things to come up during flight tests and limited deployments. You want that to come up during simulation.
Michael, when you see the commercial companies today deploying the drone technology, let's say electric aircraft, eVTOL and the like, what do you feel is spot on? And where do you think some of them are just a bridge too far? There's a overstatement of capability or overstatement of what the future could be within the timelines they're talking.
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at the past 100 years of aviation, it required, you know, like extremely visionary people who are willing to take big risks, but at the same time, making incremental engineering progress in a way that's safe. I think we got to where we are now because we've been able to learn from our mistakes that we make incrementally. And I think we need to continue doing that. So what that said, maybe some things might be a little ambitious in the near term. So I think, you know, drone delivery, I think is certainly feasible, and perhaps even in the medium term, cargo delivery, the full automation of large commercial aircraft, that's a ways off. Fundamentally, I don't think it's fundamentally impossible, of course, but that's a ways off.
So one of our guests, actually Greg Brenneman again, talked about, he's the lead director of the Home Depot, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, they're intrigued, you know, Walmart's doing some work in this area and they're looking at it. But he said, you know, generally speaking, you know, for example, with medical, golly, there's so many areas in medical. You know, he talked about, what was it, Luca, 2x2 matrix, where you had, you know, weight and value.
Yep.
And because at the end of the day, healthcare, there's all kinds of value that comes from swift delivery of things, you know, yeah. life and death and the like. And it's yeah. done a lot in some areas, mm-hmm. whether it be lab or personalized medicine, personalized chemotherapy and the like.
Yep.
But when it comes to some of the other, like he said, for example, it's going to be difficult to move a 2x4 with a drone. So is that going to, if that's an area that people are excited about, and Luca, we hear this over and over, is the ability to move bigger things going to be more likely to happen as opposed to moving passengers with some other types of vehicles?
Right. So you're going to have to, in order to move 2x4s, that's going to require a much larger platform. But I think that it is possible to automate these larger platforms. And I think, okay, so I'm not an economist, or I don't have an MBA or anything like that, but it seems like there is a significant need for cargo delivery to some of the more remote locations in the United States. And especially with a pilot shortage, it seems like this ought to make sense.
Is there anything that we have not talked about that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, it depends upon, you know, who's listening here, but maybe some of them might be interested in digging a bit more into the technical aspects of what we've been discussing. And if so, I do offer a couple courses through Stanford's online program, so anyone can register. I offer in this winter, I'm offering decision making under uncertainty, and then in the spring, engineering design optimization. Both of those classes use the textbooks that were mentioned, the algorithms for decision making and the algorithms for optimization course. I have another textbook that's available online that provides a little bit of a higher level view of decision making under uncertainty. Doesn't go into as many of the technical details, but it's called Decision Making Under Uncertainty: Theory and Application. It has an entire chapter that is spent talking about the technical aspects of ACAS-X. So that might be fun for some of your listeners.
You took a course once at Stanford, and I thought it was really interesting, your comments that you said that it completely changed your perspective on math.
Oh, yes.
Could you just take 2 minutes and explain that? Because I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, okay. So I grew up in Tracy, California. It's in the Central Valley of California. And I applied to go to Stanford for their math camp. It was a part of an outreach activity to high school students. So I went to the Stanford University math camp. I kind of felt like I knew what math was because, you know, I took pre-calculus, calculus, and I had read some math books on the side, but I didn't really understand what mathematics really was until I took this course from Rick Sommer at the at math camp. And then I realized that math is really not just, it's really not about memorizing a bunch of calculus rules or knowing long division or knowing a bunch of tricks. It's really about creativity. And I think if more people realized what mathematics really is, then we'd have a lot more people getting excited about mathematics and pursuing it.
So somebody who's raising a, you know, a 5 to 10 year old, what would you do different based on what you just said?
Oh, so I would really focus on problem solving and giving them, you know, some really fun math puzzles. There's some great YouTube videos that explain, you know, fairly advanced mathematical concepts in a way that's really accessible. And there's also Khan Academy, which I think has been game changing in terms of making mathematics available, high quality mathematics teaching and content to a broad audience for free.
Thank you for that, Michael. All right, fast forward 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
What does the industry look like? Aviation, advanced mobility, and the like.
So in that range, I would expect that beyond visual line of sight will be a thing. This will enable new applications, and it will, I think, propel an entire industry forward. In terms of like passenger carrying aircraft, I hope to see a lot of innovative designs, eVTOL and other forms of innovative designs. That will, of course, require greater levels of autonomy. I think we won't really see fully autonomous passenger carrying aircraft, but perhaps cargo aircraft.
And if you are a betting man, when would you be very confident we'll see fully autonomous passenger aircraft?
Oh, I have no idea. My epistemic uncertainty there is just so huge. no idea there.
What about advice that you would give to someone who wants to start a business in advanced air mobility?
The advice there is figure out what your performance metrics are. What are the things that you care about? Come up with good models of your environment and sensor systems. Really have at the forefront safety, and because of that, really have as much as possible a good characterization of all these edge cases that your system will have to deal with, and allocate, you know, a portion of the budget to a whole bunch of simulation.
And you may have already answered this question, but what's the most common misconception or misunderstanding on this topic? It may be the same thing that people don't agree with you on.
Yeah. I think the main misconception is that validation is easy. It's not. And it's because of all those edge cases.
Michael, we could go on for a long time with what you've done and the work, what you're doing today. It's been a terrific talk. How would you summarize your talk in a minute or so for our audience?
I think a high level summary is, I guess there are two parts. The first part is to build reliable, robust system. You need to be able to characterize your sensor error characteristics. You need to have models of the human behavior and your environment. So not just the physics of the system, but what the operators of the aircraft will be wanting. And you need to optimize your system for a variety of different performance metrics. Then the second part is, how do you go about doing the validation? For that, you need an independent set of models, as high fidelity as you possibly can obtain. And you run a whole bunch of simulations, and you characterize the various failure modes. Once you see those failure modes, you need to decide what to do with them. And part two, unfortunately, is about 90% of the effort. Part one is about 10%. And so get ready for that. And as much as possible, try to keep the models and maybe to some extent the staff and engineers who are working on it independent between those two parts. Mm-hmm. You want to, as much as possible, have fresh eyes looking at the validation of that system.
Luca, anything else from you?
Thank you very much, Michael. This was a very interesting conversation. Thank you for being on the Vertical Space.
Thanks for the invitation.
All right, that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening to the Vertical Space podcast. Reach out if there are topics that you would like us to discuss, and goodbye until the next episode. Unless mentioned, this podcast is in no way endorsing or promoting any person and or company mentioned, and all opinions within the podcast are solely that of the presenters. The Vertical Space makes no guarantees, warranty, or representation of any information given in this podcast. Any information given is for informational purposes and should be used at your own risk. This podcast is for general, educational, and entertainment purposes only.